Welcome to Coaching the Whole Educator, the podcast that helps instructional coaches, teacher leaders, and school leaders. I'm Becca, former educator and school coach turned transformational coach of coaches. I'm on a mission to help you improve your educators' effectiveness and resilience, especially the ones who need it most. Each week, we'll cover quick tips, strategies, and coaching mindsets so that you can be on top of your coaching game. Are you ready? Let's dive in. And now a quick word from our sponsor. Coaches, we know it might seem like a hassle to gather classroom observation data and be present during a teacher's lesson. What would it be like if that was done for you? The ability to see trends in student talk versus teacher talk, high quality questioning, wait time, and even grade level academic vocabulary could make a big difference in upgrading the quality of instruction. SIBME has recently upgraded its coaching platform to include all of these capabilities using AI technology. All you have to do is capture video or audio of the lesson using your phone, and SIBME does the rest. How cool is that? And one of the things I love the most about SIBME is that it stays all confidential on the platform. Visit SIBME.com/TWE for your free trial, or click the link in the show notes. Hello, 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 coaches and leaders. I am so excited. I'm like a little bit of a fangirl of my guest today, and I'm so happy to have him on the show, Dr. Chris Lee.
Well, thank you so much. I'm super excited to be here.
So you're very well accomplished in the world of kind of like neuroscience. You know a lot. You do a lot with organizations. I'd love you to share with everyone, what has been kind of your journey to, like, where did you kind of start around neuroscience, and what's been your journey and where have you ended up? What do you do now with organizations?
Great question. So go back 7 years and I was getting my doctorate, really thought that I was going to get the 2.5 dogs, 1.6 kids, like the American dream, white picket fence, you know, a little bit of alcoholism by the time I hit 45, like I was really going to hit that American dream. But I'm also a fond believer that deep inside of us is that like life purpose that is aching to get out and feeling the agitation of that. So many people experience that pain that we call it white ceiling syndrome now, that like you're laying in bed before you go to sleep and like staring at the ceiling, and like something inside of you is like knocking at that little door in your heart. That's like, is this it? Like, that's what that knock felt like for me. So that was me 7 years ago. And I was like, nope, like nobody's at the door, like nobody's there. And the world, universe, whatever it is, has a weird way of saying, no, like this path, like this path. So like get the nudges and then you get the whispers, then you get the screams and then you get hit by a car. So I got hit by a car and literally got sent to the hospital riding my bike back from school. I was going to Walmart to go get, if I'm going to be straight with you, I was going to get like a $3 bottle of wine and celebrate finishing midterms with my like neighbor's pirated Wi-Fi and like my grandpa's Netflix. I was broke. And I got hit by a car riding my Goodwill bike home. So I got sent to the hospital and put on bed rest. They were like, you know, hopefully you're going to heal up from this in like 6 months. And I was like, uh-huh. So that was hat number one falling. Hat number two falling is 2 weeks into that healing journey, I lost my dad to suicide. And that is really what took me into the path of like neuroscience and mental health, is like, how? Like my brother and I, who is also a doctor, like went out and he studied addiction and I studied neuroscience, because we're both like, how? Like, where did this come from? We were supposed to go to his house for a barbecue. 9 months goes by and then suddenly there I am in my early 20s and I have a kid now. And not only do I have a kid who's been the greatest thing in my entire life, but very shortly after that, it was just me and her. So I became very early on in her life, a solo single dad trying to navigate the world of finishing a degree, trying to make some money and like not hating myself along the way, fighting depression, fighting boards, like breast, like feeding my child, like all the things. And I was so broke. So all of that to where I am today, where I get to be an international speaker. We talk to like over 2 million people a month on social media. I work as a culture consultant. So that's where I was. And this is where I am. And I live down in Florida. We have an amazing life down here, but we got a good life now. And I am often grateful for the amount of challenge that got put in front of me in my early 20s to bring me here.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, your story is full of breakdowns and breakthroughs.
Yeah, it truly, like a lot of times it's like, oh, this is breaking me. And mm-hmm. it was, though, it was breaking the parts of me that no longer were going to fit the vision that I had for who I was designed to be.
Yeah, for sure.
So like me learning how to read research and learning how to like essentially transcribe complex sciences into something that I had to make sense of it for me. So I can't be the only one out here that feels like an idiot that doesn't know what to do with their mental health. So mm-hmm. instead of like, I feel like an idiot, like, let me like blame it on all of my circumstance. It's like, mm-hmm. I feel like this and can't be alone. What if I helped me and help other people along the way?
One of the things I really appreciate about your content is you put it into plain language and it's poignant. Like it is relevant and important to know. And I, you know, it's interesting. I'm actually thinking about my own strengths. I think when I was a teacher, I experienced resistance to change. And that is something that a lot of schools have a lot of attention on. And because I was resistant quite often, I'm really excellent at working with schools on resistance. And it's my own adversity that had me be that way. Not perfectionism or not being perfect.
Yeah. And like the struggle that comes from that so often, we think that like change in neuroplasticity, it's so personal developmentalized or whatever the heck it is. It's like bedazzled. When we talk mm-hmm. about like having neuroplastic changes, one of mm-hmm. those like starting factors is agitation. It doesn't feel good, but I know I'm also not alone in that as well. So like that agitation to change mm-hmm. mixed with something that has higher reward than pain in the past, those are the mm-hmm. ingredients to make some of those changes.
Exactly. I have to share this in another episode. A friend of mine, Jen, she made a language to explain to kindergarten through second graders about neuroplasticity, like was happening in the brain. I'm going to tell you the language. So she calls it pop, buzz, zap. And the pop is the agitation, like you said. So it's everyone that experiences adversity, a challenge, everyone gets a pop, the flashing of the neurons. But the difference between someone operating under growth mindset and fixed mindset is the buzz. So people with fixed mindset, they're like, they give up, right? They move away from it. They make an excuse. I'm not going to deal with it, right? So they get the pop. I have a challenge. She calls it the oh crap moment. Mm-hmm. And then people operating with the growth mindset keep having thoughts. How am I going to overcome this? What do I need to do? Let me figure this out. Right. So they keep lighting up their neurons. I know you know the neuroscience. And so it's the buzz. So they're buzzing, their little neurons are buzzing, and then they keep going, and they finally figure it out, zap, they connect.
I love this.
How great is this? And she said,
it's so good.
She said, the kindergartners running around with neuron stickers all over.
Yes. Oh gosh, please.
I want to get adult neuron stickers. I will do this.
Somebody should definitely make that company. It doesn't amaze me, but it sometimes does, how into the brain that like elementary school kids are. Mm-hmm. Of they're like, so like there's something in my head.
No, it's so great. So we are going to talk about decision making. And I wanted to talk about this with you because I don't think I've really actually directly addressed this on my podcast. And everyone that's listening to this has to make minute by minute, sometimes second by second decisions in schools, working with teachers, working with just other adults in general. And here's my role, here's my schedule, right? This is like the thing I'm going to do. And then there's the like, how do I respond when someone's snarky to me? When a decision has to be made in this very moment, what do I say, right? Do I address the thing that's going on over there, or do I turn my head, right? So there's so many different decisions. The first thing I heard you talk about that I would love you to share with everyone is, what are the roles of intuition versus like feelings and logic? Like, where do those all live within decision-making?
So I am a thinker as a baseline. I am not super tuned into my feelings, but I am getting more and more so there. So I think the intersection of emotions, intuition, and feelings comes down to clarity of outcome. So I think this is where logic can lead you to say, great, we are on the East Coast and I know we need to go west towards like LA. So in order to do that though, we're going to have to like make some decisions along the way, because I'm down in Florida. So a part of going west is also going to be going north. Mm-hmm. Right. But if I only look at it logically, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Right. So I kind of have to like tune and say, okay, where does that actually lie? Alongside of that though, is saying, great, there's linear decisions, which are the goals that I want to execute upon. Does this feel right for me? Right. And this is where I think we have grossly stepped out of humanity and like the human part of making decisions to say like, this makes sense. Right. Mm. And like, oh, this makes sense, but like, does it feel good to me? Mm. And we completely disrespect that. Right. Mm. And oftentimes what we end up doing instead is like, okay, I made this decision and it doesn't feel good. It doesn't like really feel like anything. And as time goes by, that emotional numbness has just been like kind of like a triggering of behaviors. So like, I kind of got to go down a rabbit hole here really quick. So when you make new decisions, and if it's a novel experience, your brain is going to have resistance to it. Your brain doesn't look at what things are. Your brain looks at what does this look like, right?
Okay.
So if you've at any point in your past made a novel decision to do something new and it didn't work out perfectly, and like maybe somebody broke up with you, or you've, you know, had financial disciplines that, you know, came back and bit you, your nervous system is going to go, hey, you're making a new decision. This really looks like that one time in 2015. Don't do this. Mm-hmm. And it'll fire up that type of sensory perception. And then it'll say, this is what that feels like. Remember, right? Mm-hmm. And this is why you kind of have to have both logic and emotions together to say like, oh, I'm having this emotional experience. Is it truly like a divine connection to my heart? And is my being truly led, or is this a predictive mechanism? And the way that you determine that, and this is like a hard thing, is where is the origin of thought? Did I think my way into feeling, or did I feel my way into thinking? Right? I think an authentic or genuine intuitive sense allows you to feel inspired and drawn towards an idea, which can still feel scary, versus if it originates with thought, that is your mind and your brain saying, this looks like that, don't do it. It was scary last time and it hurt us. Don't follow through. This feeling feels like this. So the origin of fear, when it's a non-intuitive thought, tends to push us away, versus having the recognition to say, oh, I recognize that my body feels scared, but I still feel inspired to go do it.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I don't often bring this into this deep into schools, but I want to provide an access for people listening, right? That like, maybe I've never done this before. When you're looking for the origin of thought, what is it helpful to ask, how old do I feel?
That's an interesting question. For me, if I step into, and it depends on the environment too. So when I'm parenting, for example, when I'm making parental choices that I know she's not going to like, right? It's like, oh, I can feel the disappointment of 6 or 7 year old Chris feeling like I'm having to reparent that version of me. So I am an intuitive 6 year old making this decision as a parent, right? And when I am making two choices, one from a 6 year old and one from 30 year old, which I am now, I make cognitive dissonance, right? Which is a disconnect between thinking and feeling. So I think it's a great question. And if people are listening to this, like, I want to put this as the caveat of like, I've been doing this work for like 10 years to get to like that point. So if you're like, I have no idea what the heck you guys are talking about. Sweet. Awesome. Acknowledge and know that, because like,
wait,
six out of 7 days, like that's also me. But I think it is a really deep question for people to consider. And I think what questions like that really do is it puts you into a state of curiosity. You could do any bout of fear as long as curiosity is tied onto it. If it's fear in and of itself, the vacuum of that will create rumination and overthinking and freeze response over and over and over again. Nervous system will get worked up and it'll say, this anthill is a mountain. But if you take that on and say, I'm here for the sake of adventure, I'm here for the spirit of adventure, right? Mm-hmm. And I can do scary things through curiosity and intuitive set. That's what successful people do. Right. Yeah. And this is what my neurodivergent people do too, because like their risk tolerance, when they're kind of in like that more elated state, they're like, it wins, it loses. I don't really care. I'm going to do it anyways. Right. And they like shoot themselves down the rabbit hole.
One of the things I feel like we're dancing around that I just want to name is, just because something feels uncomfortable doesn't mean it's unsafe.
Yeah. So my 2 cents and a dollar and a nickel on this is that the comfortable route is also not the worst route, as long as you know you're disciplined enough to develop skill in that environment. right? So if you're going to take the comfortable route, sweet. Know yourself well enough to say that I've got traumas in my background. And I know if that I jump in, I'm going to have 2 days of crushing and executing, and then I'm going to fall on my face and probably not follow through. So if in your head, you're like, I can start, but I don't finish. I would honestly say, and I'm not trying to like bat people down, take the safe route, take the comfortable one, but do it in intervals and seasons.
Yeah. Like really being with it's tiny tweaks and micro movements. It's not, it's change happens in those, not in huge overhauls. And that's how we sustain change and not just put a bandaid on things.
Yeah.
This is really great. Okay. I want to move into our biases. Ooh. How our brain, like I want you to share, how does our brain in default ways work like against us, not against us, you know, but like, how does it naturally work? So we can know, right? So we know what we're up against. I don't know why I'm having this negative lens on it, but how does our brain, what are our brain biases that impact our decision-making?
Yeah. Your brain wants you to be happy and successful, but it wants you even more to stay alive. Right. Yes. And if we can understand that both of those things exist simultaneously and they're kind of battling out for attention, which is exactly what they're doing, is they both exist and then they battle for attention. Whatever one you feed through awareness is the one that grows stronger neural pathways. Out of the gate, though, the default mode network, which is like the overthinking rumination pathway, and then, you know, everybody's heard of the amygdala nowadays, that thing is fast. That thing is out of the box 12 times faster than your frontal cortexes. 12 times, right? The problem with it being faster is that you have to catch it in hindsight. And this is where most people are like, I don't really think negatively. And then they're like just spewing out negative self-talk. It's because your brain is thinking and acting faster than your awareness is. And those two things are different. So your awareness, you typically take action and talk the way that I'm talking right now. I'm not like in my head of like, okay, say banana. And then it's like banana. It's just, there's a fluid motion to it. Right. So it's like the system's really smart. So it breaks down these efficiencies over and over again, and it makes them subconscious. So if you can imagine having a childhood where you develop, and this is what's true, is you develop beliefs and biases and everything that happens and how it happens and why it happens from basically the age of 0 until you're like 7. This is how I talk to myself based on how my parents talk to themselves. These are what like successful people do. Like, so out of the box, 12 times faster. And the reason that most people don't know how to catch it is that they try to catch it in the moment, and you can't catch it in the moment, but you can bridge awareness to environments. So let's say that you have a hard conversation with your boss and you catch this negative thinking pattern of like, well, I shared this really good idea and this person thinks that I'm just like an idiot sandwich, right? Gordon Ramsay, like, oh my gosh, like this just doesn't make any sense. And it's basically building in these ideas and assumptions that my ideas are worthless, therefore I am worthless, right? So every time you see your boss and you don't change that pattern, you reaffirm that through lack of change. So when you don't change the pattern doesn't change itself. We have something called a negativity bias. This is what psychology teaches us, that things don't get better unless we make them better. Things negatively get worse. So they will automatically get worse. There's also a phenomenon called neurological drift that says negative attributes get worse over time, right? Mm. So this drifting is how memories get worse, not better. Negativity bias and neurological drift basically say that you stubbed your toe last Tuesday, and now you're telling your friends that you got bit by a shark the week after. And your brain doesn't, it's not taking evidence-based information. It's taking emotional-based information.
Something I wanted to, you were just saying something that just really, I wanted to share kind of a pattern I've seen in schools. We have, you know, everyone has their own past and their own stories that they talk about what's currently happening, right? Something uncomfortable is happening. I grab from my past to inform me, how do I make sense of what's happening and how do I react to what's happening? And what I find is when I'm working with coaches and leaders, sometimes what happens is something uncomfortable happens with a teacher. A teacher says, no, I'm not going to do what you told me to do. And instead of leaning in and saying, okay, let me figure out why I'm acting this way. Let me figure out maybe why they're acting this way. They move away. They lean away. And under the guise of, I'm going to say something that might be upsetting, under the guise of professionalism, I'm being professional. I'm going to hold them accountable. And so in that moment where there's maybe conflict, and what we need is actually human connection, the opposite happens. We move away. We say, I'm being professional. Well, I sent them an email. I sent them another email, right? I'm now going to hold them accountable. It is the opposite that needs to happen in that moment. And what you're talking about, like really looking at what in my brain is having me decide this, is that moment where we can move towards or move away.
Yeah. Yes. So much so. So you, what's the quote that you always say at the end of your workshops?
Oh yeah. Don't treat people the way you want to be treated. Treat them how they want to be treated.
Exactly. So what if instead I recognize that what their need is right now, how they want to be treated, is to be acknowledged for the effort that they put into that. And then in a private setting where it doesn't feel like a societal attack on their inspiration and self-worth of 6 weeks they put into this project,
yeah.
I take 30 minutes to say, mm-hmm. Hey, you crush this. Here are some things that I'd love to work with you on how we might be able to improve based on the needs of the company as well. Mm-hmm. Like, what if we started talking to people like that? That person right. will leave that meeting so inspired, so right. empowered that like the next time that they show up, their work's going to be so much more. And they're going to be so excited to work on projects like that.
Exactly. Okay. This is my last question. Cause I really want to touch on this. Not only how we've been talking about, how do we make effective decisions? How do we feel more satisfied when we're making decisions?
Yeah. So decision is a habit. Decision-making is a habit. It's a skill. Mm-hmm. And if we think about it in that regard versus yes or no's, decisions mm-hmm. exist on a spectrum. Living in the world of absolutes, I think, cripples our capacity to make long-term good decisions. Because it is a skill, we can form habits around it. And habits have three parts. Number one is a trigger, right? The mm-hmm. trigger for you is to say, I have been met with a fork in the road that requires me to go down an adventure. There is no mm-hmm. good. There is no bad. There is a spectrum of right and wrong. And the expectations are completely on my own. So, right. So you have that awareness. Number two is alignment, mm-hmm. right? And that alignment becomes with the trigger. The second one mm-hmm. in the habit formation is the behavior, right?
Behavior.
Mm-hmm. And the behavior inside of that essentially is saying, what is required of me to move forward? Right. And in terms of habit formation, that's basically what everybody says is the end, right? It's trigger behavior, trigger behavior, trigger behavior. That's not it. Right. And that's because the third step is the most missed, I would say 90%, and it's reward.
Reward.
And this is where yeah. people like, if I could teach one thing out there, it would be this. It's just like, all right, trigger, habit, like all these things over and over again. So I use extrinsic rewards a lot in my life, typically in the form of chocolate chips. And I wish I was kidding, but I'm so not. There is a literal like little thing of like stevia dark chocolate chips up there. So when I do something or I make hard decisions, like, ooh, piece candy. Like I'm rewarding myself. But here's the thing. I bundle extrinsic reward with intrinsic reward. So I am also habit forming my habit forming. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So like,
ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, right. So it's like, okay, every time I do this thing, before I have the chocolate chip, I go, yo, Chris, good job, dude. Like that was like a hard thing that you did. And then it's like reward the reward. So my system builds up an awareness of reward the reward, reward the reward, reward the reward. And then typically now, and I don't do it as much, if to be honest with you, because it works so well, is like, I don't really need the chocolate chips anymore because like my intrinsic reward mechanism is high. So when I actually go, hey, good job, right? My system actually goes, good job. Like, nice. Like mm-hmm. it actually gives me that feeling of recognition now. Mm-hmm. So when it comes down to making those decisions, if you can recognize like, is this actually going in the direction that matches my goal? Awesome. Mm-hmm. Right. And this mm-hmm. is where the three A's come in: awareness, alignment, and action. Mm-hmm. So bundling those three things together with habit formation makes people just bulletproof in how they make decisions.
And are satisfied by them, which is...
Yeah. You're rewarding yourself because most of the time we make decisions and then we're like, we second guess.
Right.
And then it's like, when you second guess yourself, the doubt that comes in is just mm-hmm. sapping all of the confidence. And all self-doubt is uncertainty in unknown environments.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. This is so great. Oh, you're so brilliant. All right. We have to wrap up. Our time is up. So thank you so much for just sharing so honestly and authentically about your own experiences with this. Like one of the things I appreciate about you is you're just so real about your infallibility. Just like you know this stuff and you still deal with it, right?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Okay. So if people want to find you, where can they find your work? I know you have a couple groups going on. Where can they access you?
Yeah. Everything's at Dr. Chrislee, DrChrislee. Everything, website, handles on social medias, everything's over there. I have an ongoing group that's focused on self-regulation, and we go through different topics every month. So it's four workshops and four book clubs a month, plus biometrics. And all of that is like $200. It is the steal of the century. I've been running that group for 4 years, and it's like just awesome. And then I run leadership development groups for the general public, which is basically what I do for agencies and consulting. But I do it for the general public. So, and that one runs about two or three times a year.
This is awesome. This is great. And just on a personal note, everyone needs to follow Chris on Instagram. It is a highlight. Every time your stuff comes up, I'm like, I need to learn this thing. Or it's just even like, it feels good. Like the way you deliver stuff, it's like, yeah, that was funny. That's why. Anyway, so I love your stuff. So highly recommend. Okay, we're going to wrap up. Thank you so much again.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. This was such a fun conversation.
The Whole Educator, we believe in human-centered coaching, really getting the things done we need to get done through people's humanity and not around it. If you're interested in learning more about what our coaching does and how we do it, check it out at thewholeeducator.com. And if you're interested in free resources for you to download, check out our free resources section in the website as well. And I will throw that link in the show notes if it's easier for you to click on it. And until next time, just remember, don't treat people the way you want to be treated. Treat them how they want to be treated. Take care.